You'll forgive me if I don't do the whole sermon in a brogue, okay? My brogue does okay for about a paragraph, and then it becomes Italian. And then the Italian deteriorates into Russian. So, you know, but the one thing I would add to the opening words is, I'm not sure how many of you would be knowing this, but you know that Barry Fitzgerald, who was always playing the priest, he was an Orangeman. He was a Protestant, he was. That's a true story. So there's hope, you know? Not much, but there's some hope. And I suppose that's the deeper meaning of my assertion this morning about St. Patrick and St. Patrick's Day, and to me the fact that there's always a snake in the garden. You all know that on the surface, the story of St. Patrick is that he shows up in Ireland and he drives all the snakes out. And if you take that fundamentalistically and literally, you're not getting the story. What it's about at the deeper literary and mythic level is St. Patrick converted all of these pagans and heathens to Christianity, and that drove the snake of Satan, of temptation, of paganism, and all the terrible violence and anger that paganism has, and it was replaced by Christianity, and so ever since, Ireland has been a lush, peaceful paradise. Well, it has been lush, it has been green, there have been some lushes there also, as well as it being lush, and it could be paradise, but the snake's still there. And we are the snake in the garden. We're also the blessings of the garden because we human beings are complicated and complex folks. On the symbolic level, the driving of the snakes out is a nice conversion story. But when you look at it more deeply, you really understand the wisdom of Pogo. Which was a cartoon figure for the youngsters here, who is famous for having said, "We have sighted the enemy and it is us." Because here's what you got to know. There were never snakes in Ireland, but there are now. Just after I put this sermon to bed, there was an article in the New York Times, so it must be true, that Ireland has a terrible problem with snakes, because during the Celtic tiger boom economy, people bought snakes as pets. And then as the economy tanked, they released those snakes into the wild. And so now Ireland has pythons. They got a lot of pythons, almost half of them named Monty. Go now. They're very, very, very creative. And all different kinds of water snakes that people got as pets, and not wanting to be cruel, they just threw them out into the lush countryside, and there are the snakes. So, where did the snakes come from? They were symbolic of temptation, from a biblical viewpoint and a mythic viewpoint of temptation. When we look at the biblical story of Eden, and I'm sure we've all heard it, read it, seen the movie, we understand that Adam and Eve were living very peacefully in the garden. They did not have to work. They were fed. They were taken care of. There was no painful childbirth, and there was no death. They had immortality. And then the snake tempted them to do the most evil of things, have a piece of fruit. Now, who knew that a piece of fruit was going to lead to eviction from the garden, having to work by the sweat of your brow, having to bear the pain of childbirth, and having to die? That seems like a severe penalty for having a high-fiber, nutritionally dense piece of fruit. But, of course, on the symbolic level, it's about knowing the difference between good and evil. It's about becoming a moral agent. It's about growing up. First of all, Adam and Eve, if you were really going to deconstruct the story, they had a really good excuse. Because until you know the difference between good and evil, there's no reason to listen to any voice out there in the garden, even if it's God's. Whether it's the still, small voice of conscience saying, you know, we shouldn't eat the fruit, or whether it's the booming voice of God saying, do whatever you want, cavort happily and nakedly, but don't eat the fruit. By the way, it never says apple in the Hebrew. It just says a puffed up ripe fruit. They had a diminished capacity plea because they were not programmed to be moral agents. The astronomer and scientist Carl Sagan says that the whole Eden story is a wonderful myth. It's the story of how we grow up to become moral agents. That as infants, we are fed, we are taken care of, we do not work by the sweat of our brow, we have no shame in our nakedness, and we have no moral responsibility, and we have no sense of our finitude, of our mortality. That Eden is childhood. And as we get older, it's not a question of becoming cynical or dirty through life. It's a question of becoming slowly responsible, slowly understanding that our actions have consequences for which we are responsible. And it's not just bad parents or bad friends or the terrible contemporary music of every generation. Their parents thought that they had terrible contemporary music that are leading people astray. It's no. With all of these environmental factors, we become responsible moral agents slowly. We learn how to be human beings. And while Christianity calls the eviction from the Garden of Eden the fall, there is a significant portion of Christianity that uses the term the blessed fall. Because the truth is, we couldn't stay in the garden. We couldn't stay in nursery school. We wouldn't want to stay in nursery school. We would want to grow up even with the pain that knowledge brings. That's the snake in the garden. That there are always trade-offs. We trade our innocence for responsibility. We trade our dependence for not independence, but interdependence with others, with people, with family, with society, with a social contract. And all of those blessings come with costs. So the fall is a blessed fall, and the curses are blessed curses, and even our blessings always have that little bit of a snake in the garden. They come with a cost. The social contract comes with a cost. We trade our freedom to be anarchic for some security in making a deal with each other. You know, Ben Franklin, who was not a card-carrying Unitarian, but attended one of the first Unitarian services in England, is often misquoted. He's misquoted as saying, those who would trade their freedom for security deserve neither. That's not the quote. The real quote is, those who would trade their essential liberty for temporary safety deserve neither. Those are very big qualifiers. The misquote sounds very absolutist. But the truth is, all of us make a bargain with our freedom and our responsibility, our impulses and our social contract. We, for example, sometimes we join congregations, and that limits our freedom to yell and scream in the middle of a sermon that you might be bored. You can leave politely, but there's a social contract of how we are in this room. There's a social contract how we are with each other. There's a social contract about what our responsibilities are in the larger society. We trade portions of our freedom for a greater freedom and a sense of intimacy. We get married sometimes frequently. And it's okay for me as long as I charge retail for each of them. I don't have a moral view on that. But it was funny because there was one guy that invited me to do his to marry him for the third time. And I said, that just feels like bigamy to me. Go find another clergy person. But I too, you know, that's okay. But we get married. We trade some freedom for intimacy, for love, for really getting to know and connect with another human being. And it's not easy, and it's not a self-evident trade, and it doesn't always work. But it's usually worth the risk because the payoff can be so great. Many of us have children, and that's a trade-off of freedom. I can see that you got that one. That's a trade-off of freedom, economic and personal freedom, and the ability to go to movies and plays and travel. And we trade that off, again, for intimacy, for intimations of immortality through our children, and for being connected to the future. Because one of the great payoffs for children is it's a very specific therapy against despair. Because I don't get to give up on the world. I can look at the headlines and get really annoyed, angry. I can start to feel depressed and helpless and want to say, oh, the hell with it. They're just all a bunch of fools. I'm out of this. But then I have these three children. And I have these three daughters-in-law. And I have these seven grandchildren. And so what happens next year? What happens next decade? What happens in 50 years to our society, to this earth, to the air, to the water, is important to me today. That's what the connection to children and grandchildren does. I trade off some things as I look at what, oh, good Lord, even elementary school could cost and what college could cost and the savings that are going into that. I know the financial costs. There are trade-offs. And when we make them consciously, they are the deepest and most important things that we do. There are trade-offs even in science, a sense of wonder that sometimes science just says, well, okay, you can have your sense of wonder, but you have to understand that it's not magic. It is something that we understand and explain. And that doesn't diminish the wonder for me, but it does for some. There was a line in some movie, and I haven't been able to find the full quote, but going to the moon was an extraordinary accomplishment, but it took some of the mystery out of the moon, finding out it wasn't green cheese, and it was just this pockmarked thing up there, and we reached it. There is, in reaching for a certain kind of energy and meaning and achieving another kind, and there are always going to be trade-offs. There are no Edens without snakes. And I guess the news is that human beings are the snakes, the chaos, the temptation. We are cunning and can be deceptive. We can be the motive of the centrifugal force that pushes society and people away from each other. That's part of what human beings can do. And we are also the wisdom, the compassion, the connection, the love that impels us to come together and to join together and to be, if only for moments, one with one another. It is the deepest sense of spiritual love, of, as we sing in one of our hymns, we would be one, as one we join in singing. And when we sing together, we experience that sense of connection. Each person, with all of our voices, some of them weak, some of them strong, some of them on key, some of them having a tangential relationship with the pitch as three voice teachers told me I had. We make music together nonetheless. All of those voices, disparate, coming together in a moment of experience, of creating something that is greater than the sum of its parts. There's cost to community. There's cost to love. There's always a trade-off, always a snake in the garden. But as long as we're alive, we get to choose consciously to move ourselves from the chaos towards, if only for moments, the unity. From the anger to the love. From being rent asunder by all of the temptations of ego and individual impulse to the greatest social contract of intimacy, of connectedness, of interdependence, and the perception that we would be one with one another, with the earth and air and sky and time. We are creatures of time here for a little while, but what we do together today makes a difference tomorrow and forever. So maybe that snake is the responsibility, the blessed responsibility of knowing that our lives make a difference. It is ambivalent. It goes both ways. But we don't get to say no, to step back forever and say, just let the great world spin all by itself. While we're here, we have something to say and something to do about how we spin apart and or come together for a moment in a sense of unity and connectedness.